Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Once again, it's my pleasure to be able to share positive insights into the human condition. Today, we're beginning with a study published in Biological Research for Nursing, and it's from Zhejiang University in China, and it talks about the more antioxidants that you take in, that's vitamin C and E and zinc, is linked to a lower risk of gout. And that's important. It's known today that a lot of Americans have gout. Why? Gout's a type of inflammatory arthritis caused by elevated uric acid that leads to the formation of painful sodium urate crystals in joints, tendons, and surrounding tissues. So the formation of monosodium urate, and this creates a hyperuricemic and results in inflammation. The endothelial oxidative damage occurs, oxidative stress by stimulating a nicotinamide, adenine dinucleotide, or NADPH oxidases. This is a little technical, but in lay language, it means this. When they took a look at 26,000 adults, 40 to 59, enrolled in their National Health and Nutrition Survey, they found that those that have a lot of meat, well, there's your pork, meat, chicken, and fish, that can cause a uric acid to go up, and that causes gout. Used to be, it was called the Emperor's Dilemma, and then it was led to the royals or the nobility who could afford to eat a lot of meat, and that caused a lot of gout. And back in France, it was so ridiculous at one time that they had such high protein diets because that showed that you could afford venison or you could afford pork. And they had these swollen feet and mainly swollen big toes. Starts generally with the swollen big toe, but can also happen in your joints as well. And they were told that, well, pouring bird blood on it. So they would take all the birds they could find, kill them, and drain their blood, and pour the blood over the outside of the foot or elbow. It didn't do any good. It just decimated all the birds, which then increased all the insects. Kind of stupid. But now we know high protein diets, not good for you. They're not good for your kidneys, not good for your liver. You don't need all that meat to begin with. In fact, you need nothing from an animal. Nothing at all. Not its milk, not its flesh, not its gelatin, not its collagen. And yet we use all that. And you would think with all the science and nutrition we have, and we have a lot of science and nutrition, that why would we waste all the money? It's expensive. And decimate all of the land, especially in the Amazon, where they clear thousands and thousands of acres of lush trees that hold the carbon in the ground, carbon sinks, so they can plant it for cattle. That cattle is then exported to China or to the United States to be used in our hamburgers, when we don't need any of that to begin with. And I know that because I'm the scientist that as a senior research fellow at the Institute of Biology, it was purely serendipitous, but I was wanting to know after my travel to the rainforest and to Venezuela and Brazil, why is it that people have not a lot of meat in the diet? Their diet is primarily rice and beans, different rice, and lots of starchy vegetables like breadfruit. Why? Why don't they shrivel up? Why don't they have loss of muscles? And because we were living this myth that we have to have meat three times a day, and the more meat, the better. Even growing up, I remember the butcher was right across the street from our house. And once a week, my mother would go over, and she would get, on a Saturday, she would buy meat, she'd buy steaks, and she made sure that there were 2 inches thick. Now, why 2 inches? Well, because there was this middle-class myth that you were a responsible person if you could show that you were feeding your family a 2-ounce steak. And of course, on Sunday, it was always everywhere for everyone. It was a roast beef. You'd put the roast beef in the oven with all of the vegetables and put it on a certain heat. And then when you came back from church, you'd be ready to eat. And, of course, being the person that didn't want to eat the meat, My mom would always put potatoes and carrots and whatever vegetables we had around it, and it all was mush. I couldn't tell you what was what, because, well, everything had kind of overcooked, and there was a tendency to overcook everything back then. But the idea is you have to have your meat so you grow up big and strong. You have to have the dairy to have strong bones. None of that was true. In fact, just the opposite. So today, I started doing research on the protein analysis of red beans because I saw they had a lot of red beans and black beans in South America. Very common and not a lot of meat because they were too poor to have meat. And I found that the beans had all 8 essential amino acids, essential in the sense that we could not make them ourselves. We had to get them from outside, exogenous sources outside the body. And I thought I made a mistake. So I left a note for Dr. Berman. Vic, I've made a mistake here. Could you duplicate what I did on this analysis, the protein, amino acid, the nitrogen, and beans? I came back the next day to the lab, and there was another note. No problem. You're correct. What he said was, no, you're correct. There's no problem. So I thought, that's strange. And I didn't believe it. I had several other people do my work, and they all came up with the same thing. No, there are 8 amino acids here. So I thought, well, this can't be. This is impossible. Because every textbook, including the very respected and very regarded Norman Therapeutic Nutrition by Robinson, the one I used, that everyone used, who was, in dietetics nutrition, said that only animals can give you the essential amino acids, and hence the diet should be based upon that as your source of protein. And then other things, such as the vegetables and fruits, were so incomplete that you couldn't get a lot out of them, and so people had very few vegetables. Most of the people who ate a meal when I was growing up would eat meat as the center of that, whether it was chicken and not a lot of fish, but different types of meat. And then there would be potatoes. And almost everybody had the same thing, mashed potatoes. And the lazy ones would get it out of a box, and just add the ingredients and heat it up. But my mother liked to make them from scratch. So she'd boil the potatoes and peel them and then mash them up with that little hand masher. And then add in the milk and butter and salt and pepper. I mean, that's, or some people would use lard. And then to make the gravy, and it stunk to high heavens, she would take out of a box this dried cow's blood and put it in the skillet with some lard, and it would bubble up. It was gross. I mean, totally gross. And I get on a chair and I go up and I look at the stove and I smell it. I said, Mom, this stinks. She says, yeah. And then they would put a lot of salt and pepper in it. That was a seasoning. And then they would pour that gravy into the middle of the mashed potatoes. And that's what we ate. Iceberg lettuce with a tasteless tomato. Yeah. Not a lot of good nutrition there. But fortunately, we got outside, we got a lot of sunlight, we ran, we played, we were very fit, there was virtually almost no obesity at all, and we were happy, yeah. Working class people were happy, and we got good educations, so it was not a bad time to be raised. But people did have gout. And people had diabetes and people had arthritis because nobody limited the amount of sugar that you ate because there was nothing wrong with sugar, we were told. And all the ads said sugar. And the dietitians that read the journals from the association, these were all processed food companies. So you were supposed to have the eggs and the bacon, right? Nothing healthy. Nothing healthy. We're lucky we survived it all, but we did. So today, if you're on one of these protein diets, you're prematurely aging your body. You're taking in known cancer-causing agents, heterocyclic amines from the cooked meats, and acrylamides from the browned products, from brown muffins to pretzels to potato chips to french fries. Yeah. all the science we've put together, all of the great clinical work we've done, and we're still eating garbage. Wow. So anyhow, I remember spending over a year trying to measure every day the amino acid composition of every food. It took over a year. And I was finally finished, and a Dr. Hillard Fitzke came in, and he had a computer, and I didn't. And he did an analysis of the 8 essential amino acids in which foods in normal edible combinations could you combine up to 3 foods to exceed the net protein utilization of any food product. And we had over 5,000, I repeat, 5,000 combinations of vegan plant-based foods that gave you more protein, higher quality protein, and a deeper utilization of that protein than any animal protein. And we exceeded the egg, because the egg in all of health and all of nutrition, all of dietetic science, was considered the ultimate net protein utilization product. And so I submitted a paper, and it was called the Egg Project, based upon, for the first time in nutritional history of all science, we showed you did not need to ever eat anything from an animal. It was revolutionary. And nobody would touch it. They wouldn't say it was wrong, because our science was perfect. Our truth was absolute. But we didn't know, and I was not terribly bright and extremely naive. I thought, as a young scientist, and I spoke with the director of the institute 1 month at our meeting, and I said, now we can send plants and seeds to Africa so that they don't have to get our non-fat dry milk in order to have the protein they need. And he looked at me and he smiled, and I said, well, think of all the people in America who are too poor to get meat, and now they'll know healthy selections of vegetables and nuts and legumes and beans and seeds that they can eat and get all their protein. And he said, Gary, he said, it's not going to happen. Nothing that you do will make a difference in this world. And I looked at him and I thought, did I do something wrong? He said, no. What you did, no one else in science has ever done, but it will make no difference. I said, why not? He said, because do you think that the people who raise chickens and raise beef and pork and fish and dairy, and do you think they're going to give them up and say, okay, everyone, this actually causes disease, prematurely ages you. There's no science backing up anything we've been selling you for decades. It's all propaganda. And Gary, come on in with your, you know, fruits and vegetables and see how that goes. First, people are not going to change, Gary. You underestimate the capacity. I never will forget this. This stung in my brain. He said, Gary, you have underestimated the capacity of people to resist even what's in their own best interest. This was a very wise man. He lived to 102 and worked to the day he died. He said, and secondly, no one in Washington is going to support this. You're not going to get a new dietary health chart of, you know, the basic groups of food. It'll still be all the bad foods, the majority of what's on the pyramid, and maybe fruits and vegetables as an add-on. That was one of the meetings I walked out. I didn't feel particularly happy. But he was right. But to his credit, he said, but look, you have done something that deserves attention. No one else has done it. And we're going to do a press conference on it. And he did. Took over a high school. For a whole day, the auditorium, it was filled. Some of you, I bet, were there. I introduced the Egg Project, he introduced me, and then I introduced the research and how it came about, and that I said the good news is that you never have to eat anything that has a heartbeat or face again. In fact, to do so, you're actually harming the environment because of all the methane gases that go into the atmosphere. You're harming people's health and your own, and there's a better way. and here's 5,000 combinations. And a woman came up to me afterwards, and we had a lot of people in the audience asking questions, so it went on for hours. And she said, I won't mention her name because she's still there, and she's very important at the United Nations. And she said, this is revolutionary because we're going to be able to help a lot of people in Africa who will now not starve to death, because a lot of them have a genetic predisposition against lactose. And what do we give them? Non-fat dry milk. And he said, this woman said, so I'm going to get this and we're going to give this to our people in the development program and food program of Africa. 5 years later, I meet this person at a lecture I was giving, and she comes up, she says, you remember me? I said, yeah. She said, I did my best, but the politics at the UN is so complete, and the control by special interest groups so complete, that they told me to forget it. And she said, that's the way the world works. So the director was right. And my thoughts of helping the people were not wrong. I was just too naive to realize that even what's in our best interest, we're almost always going to do the opposite. Anyhow, I want to share that with you because it not only causes gout when you're on a hyperindividual diet, which can be excruciatingly painful, but then it creates these cytokine storms throughout the whole body. You're far more susceptible to disease. Now, from the University of North Carolina comes a study about reduced vitamin D levels is linked with low ovarian reserves. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause. And it's an article that reveals that you don't want to be deficient in vitamin D because there's going to be a direct effect on an increase in follicle-stimulating hormone, or FSH, which becomes elevated with the decline in ovulation that occurs during menopause. And this was a part of the Environmental Health Science Uterine Fibroid Study from the National Institutes of Environmental Health. And 75% of the participants were deficient entering, and they didn't know it. They thought they were healthy. In vitamin D, it was below 20 nanograms per millimeter. And for each 10 nanograms increase in serum vitamin D, an adjusted 14% decrease in urinary FSC was observed. And by the way, that just corroborates the studies examining the association between vitamin D levels and the AMH hormone, another indicator of ovarian reserve. So, and earlier menopausal studies have been documented that showing women with lifelong reduced sun exposure also have the same problem. So you need vitamin D for a lot of reasons. And for the women in the audience, remember, vitamin D will influence ovarian reserve and as such may have implications for older women. And finally, from the University of Cambridge and Fudan University, healthy lifestyle can help prevent depression. That's the newest research, and this shows why. And I'm sure many of you already know this, but a healthy lifestyle involves moderate consumption to low consumption and no consumption of things that are bad for you. So if you have the idea that moderation in all things, that's not good. And yet, the entire population of America was told that by the medical community for over 100 years. Moderation. Well, how much is a moderate amount of a toxin like mercury? How much? Well, there is no such thing as a moderate amount. No amount's good. And how much alcohol? Well, a moderate amount of alcohol. Well, I know people that came to see me. In fact, there was one lawyer came to see me who said that he didn't understand, Gary. I don't understand what's wrong. I do everything right about my health. I exercise. You know, I'm in a very stressed job, but I try to do stress management. I go to a Pilates class, and yet I've got all these really elevated risk factors. Homocysteine's up and C-reactive protein. I could have a heart attack anytime, and I don't know why. I'm 45 years old. And so we went through the diet, and indeed he had a healthy diet. And his lifestyle was, I would suggest, okay. And I said, is there anything you've done differently in the last 2 years since this happened? He said, no. No, in fact, 2 years ago, I would see my cardiologist to have a cardiac stress test, as I heard you say on the radio. And he put me on, you know, he said, my protocol's on. The only thing he added for my heart was alcohol each day. He said, the studies have shown alcohol, two drinks are good. So I have two glasses of alcohol each day. What kind of alcohol? Red wine? No. He didn't say I had, you know, what kind of alcohol. So I have bourbon, a glass of bourbon. How much bourbon? About 2 ounces of bourbon and then seltzer water. So you're having 4 ounces of a really high alcohol content. That's going to destroy millions of brain cells. It's going to destroy your vitamin C, folic acid, B1, B6, and B12, all of which keep your inflammatory markers low. Wow. And that's when I went ahead and did a report and an article about the dangers of alcohol, because I'm the one who wrote the book in 1975, Alcohol Nutrition, showing it's deadly in any amount. We should have no alcohol at all. Yeah. So we got rid of the alcohol completely and started taking fresh-made juices, and every one of his inflammatory markers came down to normal and took him out of harm's way. So a healthy lifestyle means don't do anything in moderation if it's a toxic content product. Have an abundance of healthy choices, an abundance of exercise, abundance of fruits and vegetables and legumes and nuts and seeds, organic and locally grown wherever possible, abundance of fresh-made juices, yeah, to your body's needs. And that impacts stress and reduces your risk of stress-related depression. And sedentary activity also causes depression. So get up and exercise. Be active. And that will end up impacting genetics, brain structure, our immune system, and our metabolic systems. That is what is counting. All right? Healthy diet, regular physical exercise, healthy sleep, never smoking. And don't be sedentary. Infrequent social connection. We're social animals. We need to socialize. We need healthy social relationships. That's all we have for health and nutrition. So we're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. As a society, we tend to believe our leaders, those who've risen to a place of respect, those who we are told have wisdom that we do not, and so pay attention to them. Okay. With Anthony Fauci and AIDS, we paid attention. He did not inform us that we should be building up our immune systems, that there were non-toxic and natural remedies that could help us. No, he wanted us to take a particular drug, and that was AZT. We now know the consequences of that. He denies that he was responsible for that, but we have video at the time showing him promoting it. Then comes along AIDS, and he says, you know, you have to mask, or you have to stay at home and quarantine. Now that we see the deadly effects of that all over the world, scientists by the thousands and physicians are showing everything we did was wrong, he says he didn't do it. He says he didn't tell us this. I didn't tell you, you know, to stay at home or quarantine. And he does this all the time. Well, this time you decide. Did he say to quarantine or not? Here's a clip. Here's Anthony Fauci, and it's dated, and you can go to our footnotes, but I'm going to play it for you. Now to Anthony Fauci contradicting himself. The utter hypocrisy of no one in the media, no one in the establishment, calling him out, calling him a liar. Here it is.
First of all, I didn't recommend locking anything down.
And the record will show
Neil, that we didn't recommend shutting everything down.
I recommended to the president that we shut the country down. And that was a very difficult decision because I knew it would have serious economic consequences, which it did.
Now, but we have more hypocrisy. We have massive hypocrisy. For example, we'll say that we need to go into a country because we need to bring them freedom, and we lie. And we bring them tyranny and war and suffering and destruction. And it's not political. I don't care who's in power, and I've said this for a long time, because the Democrats and Republicans, no matter where they're at in power, they seem to screw everything up and only end up benefiting themselves and the sponsors, or not sponsors, they don't like that word. The lobbyist, that's a more sanitized word. So the lobbyist who come in and help them get reelected, they then listen to and create laws or even allow the lobbyist to write the laws that we follow. Well, what about the people that tell the truth? We support whistleblowers in this country, says Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Do you? Okay, good. So those who show crimes against humanity committed by those in power, you support them being exposed? Mm-hmm. Well, we take issue with that. And just like the hypocrisy and the lies of pathological personalities like Fauci, we had the Obamas and the Clintons and the Bushes and the Trumps. And here's an example of it in depth. We're going to take you now to a clip by Johnny Harris, who I disagree with on several issues. But again, I want you to see the work he's put together, because on this one I agree. Julian Assange should not be in prison being extradited to the United States. He should be a worldwide hero, because he's never been shown to be inaccurate, not once, in all the documents he's released, exposing crime at every level of our government. So for showing who was committing crimes and that not being at issue, he has been punished. What was it, 7 years in the embassy in Great Britain, now in prison? Yes, because he told the truth and people in power were embarrassed by it. So just think of it this way. Those who commit the crimes against humanity cause death and destruction by millions of people being displaced and poisoned with depleted uranium and killed. They are rewarded, and the media does not touch them. And the person exposing the crimes, they go to jail. How is that possible? But it is. Here's the clip.
On a spring day 10 years ago, a 41-year-old Australian man named Julian Assange dressed up as a motorcycle delivery man. He dyed his hair, put colored contacts in his eyes, and even put a rock in his shoe so that he would walk differently than normal. He was sure he was being followed by dark government forces that were attempting to capture him and send him to the United States to be locked up. He showed up here, to the embassy of Ecuador in central London. Once inside this embassy, he wouldn't be on British soil anymore. No one could barge in here and grab him. He'd be safe. It's called political asylum. Oh, and by the way, this isn't actual footage of Julian Assange in 2012.
Action!
You're great.
This is an actor. We did a reenactment of this whole thing. Anyway. Assange did make it inside that day, and after entering the Ecuadorian embassy in London, he wouldn't leave it for 7 years.
Testing 1, 2, 3. I've been looking at a lot of this. I've actually started hanging up the documents over here because they've been taking up too much space. I want to tell you the story of Julian Assange.
This guy's a traitor.
I love WikiLeaks.
This is a blow to transparency and a blow to a free press.
What this story is like an expression of a new kind of power. The power of secrets, of information.
An anti-war online organization attacking US policy in Afghanistan.
And the reason I'm calling what Julian Assange does power is because the US is trying to lock him up for 175 years because of what he did. It's all here in this indictment. The most powerful country in the world feels threatened by this man and what he's done. I want to take you through Julian Assange's story and then to unpack why the United States is trying to lock him up for the rest of his life. And I want to persuade you that no matter what you think of Julian Assange and his conduct and his ethics and his mission, this case should not be ignored.
Illegally shoot the son of a bitch.
Get Assange to Sweden and hang on to him.
Radio Horse 1-8-5-6 individual with AK-47.
You never know what the outcome is, but the truth is always the best place to start.
Come on, fire!
Okay, let's get up to speed really quickly on who this guy even is and how he ended up trapped in an embassy in London. Julian Assange is an Australian hacker who spent most of his life breaking into computers and getting his hands on information that he wasn't supposed to see, but that he believed the world should see. When he was 35, he built a website where whistleblowers of all kinds could upload sensitive information that he, Julian Assange, on his new website would publish. And the upside of all of this was that these whistleblowers would remain totally anonymous. He claimed that even he wouldn't know who his sources were. So that was 2006. Julian Assange builds WikiLeaks. And soon after, he starts receiving submissions. Like, people start giving him documents that are supposed to be secret, and he starts publishing them. Everything from drone strikes in Yemen, to oil scandals in Peru, to corruption in the Arab world, Tibetan uprisings in China. Leaks like this sort of seem common to us now, but this was like 2007. WikiLeaks was a totally new thing. It was this open source intelligence website acting in the name of no government, with no location, but with this very idealistic vision of making the world's information totally transparent, exposing corruption, exposing government secrets.
Understand how far you can push government into doing something that is just, by exposing injustice.
But WikiLeaks wasn't really noticed until 2010, when something happened that would change everything. In Iraq, there was a 22-year-old American intelligence analyst named Chelsea Manning. Horrified by what she was seeing, she decided to download hundreds of thousands of classified documents from military computers and upload them directly to WikiLeaks.
Reports our top story this morning, the White House blasting the release of over 90,000 U.S. military records.
It was the biggest leak in history. And this is the stuff we've been looking through over the past few weeks. Hundreds of thousands of classified documents containing never-before-seen details on how the U.S. conducts its war, its diplomacy, its intelligence. I mean, let me show you some of this stuff. Now, let me just do a quick disclaimer here. Going through these leaks, there is a lot of, like, horrific stuff. Like, stuff I just don't even want to talk about here. I'll go over it kind of in vague terms and let you go read the rest. But war is horrible. And what these documents reveal is like a detailed version of that.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
In these leaks, we learn about secret raids. We read about scenes of US military people executing Iraqi families. We also get a lot of data. The US military claimed that it wasn't keeping track of deaths in Iraq, but these leaks showed that they actually were, and that the number of casualties, including civilian deaths, was actually way higher than anyone thought before. The leaks also revealed this classified footage that, again, I'm not going to show all of it here or even the worst parts.
There's more than keep walking by, and one of them has a weapon.
Sullivan, copy that, White 6.
That's a weapon.
It shows a U.S. helicopter firing on a group of Iraqis who they thought were insurgents, but was really just a family, including children, walking with two Reuters journalists.
Right.
Hotel 26 is Crazy Horse 1-8.
They were carrying cameras, not guns.
Request permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
And yet in this video, you see them open fire on these people.
You know, 3-2, engage, over.
When the state line, let me know when you gather. 4-2. Light them all up. Come on, fire.
Hey, roger.
Oh yeah, look at those dead bastards.
Nice.
Oh, it's their fault for bringing their kids to a battle.
That's right.
You read about this scene where an Apache helicopter is flying over some insurgents in a house who are surrendering. They're coming out of their house with their hands up. And yet the Apache helicopter gets the clearance to fire on them. And their justification is, according to this leaked log, you're not allowed to surrender to aircraft. They're still valid targets. I mean, it's horrendous. As a journalist, I'm skeptical. I'm like, okay, these are like two or three bad apples. Is this what we're staring at? But no. Through these leaks, you see that 15,000 civilians were killed in previously unknown incidents. 15,000. These documents reveal a culture and a system of abuse and torture in Iraq, mostly by the Iraqi military and army, that the US military knew about but did nothing to solve. And the only reason why we know about it now is because Chelsea Manning gave WikiLeaks all of these documents. There's one Department of State leak from the embassy in Belgium that shows that the US tried to pressure Belgium into taking some of the prisoners from Guantanamo Bay in order to curry favor with the US. You see the US being like, hey Belgium, take some of these Guantanamo prisoners. It's a low-cost way for Belgium to attain prominence in Europe. Like, it's backroom deals exchanging Guantanamo prisoners for political favors. We would have not known any of this had these leaks not come out. All of this turned out to be a very grim insight into how the US is conducting its wars. And unsurprisingly, after these giant leaks came out in 2010 and 2011 on WikiLeaks, the Pentagon was furious.
This was dumped on us like it was dumped on you all Sunday night.
It is the role of good journalism to take on powerful abuses. And when powerful abuses are taken on, there is always a back reaction.
Julian Assange's website had gone from being a small hacker website with some leaks to something that now had worldwide attention.
This isn't a WikiLeak, this is a WikiTorrent.
These documents have generated a mix of reactions from horrified to appalled.
And Assange himself became the public face for this. And he became really polarizing. He was either praised as a courageous journalist.
The role that Julian Assange has played in exposing uncomfortable truths is something that he should be very proud of.
WikiLeaks is no different from the New York Times.
He just believes in justice, believes in honesty, believes in exposing governments.
Or he was reproached and condemned as a villain who was set on damaging the US security interest and putting people in danger in the process.
I hope he rocked in hell, starting with that.
This guy's a traitor, a treasonous, and he has broken every law of the United States, illegally shoot the son of a b-.
But regardless of what the public thought about him, the reality is the US government now felt like they were at war with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
The United States strongly condemns the illegal disclosure of classified information. There have been examples in history in which official conduct has been made public in the name of exposing wrongdoings or misdeeds. This is not one of those cases.
And the next chapter of his life would be spent trying to avoid being sent to the US to face them. And this is why Julian Assange went to the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Okay, so after this huge leak, it's now like 2012, Assange is living in London, and he's actually facing the possibility of being sent to Sweden to face an investigation into sexual misconduct allegations. And even though this Sweden investigation legally has nothing to do with the big leaking thing that he had done, Assange was convinced that the UK and Sweden were working with the US to try to get Assange back onto US soil to face trial. So instead of go and participate in the investigation, he fled to seek political asylum inside the walls of this embassy. An embassy is kind of like a little enclave within a country. Like, this is a little slice of Ecuador within London. So the UK couldn't do anything. They couldn't go storm into an embassy. So instead, they just positioned a ton of police outside of the embassy. And this is the moment, this spectacle of all these police sitting outside of the embassy where you realize that this is a huge deal. On paper, this was actually a really small deal. The US wanted to arrest Assange, to send him to Sweden, to face this sexual misconduct investigation. But all of this shows us that this is not about a small investigation in Sweden. The US wanted Assange to punish him for what he did. And the UK, it was looking like, was ready to help them. So while Assange is in the walls of this embassy, he's protected. And the US would have to wait him out, building their case. But wait a minute, hold on. What exactly are we charging Assange with here? He published a bunch of leaked documents, so what's the crime here? And honestly, that is the heart of this story. What crime did he commit? I'm gonna get there. I wanna just finish the story of what happens next. Julian Assange is in an embassy in London. The weeks turn into months, and the months turn into years, and Julian Assange is living in an embassy, not leaving. He occasionally comes out onto this balcony to deliver a speech to his increasingly large support base.
Can you hear me?
But like, this guy is confined to the embassy.
Well, I joked it's a little bit like living in a space station because there's no natural light and you've got to make all your own stuff and you can't go out to shops and so on.
From the embassy, Assange continues to run WikiLeaks. He publishes troves of secret documents. It is from the embassy that he declares his hate for Hillary Clinton.
The American liberal press, in falling over themselves to defend Hillary Clinton, are erecting a demon that is going to put nooses around everyone's necks.
And it is here that he orchestrates a plan to damage her campaign by strategically publishing emails that were stolen from the Democratic Party and from Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta. WikiLeaks posted these emails in daily batches throughout October 2016, a month before the election. Soon, mounting evidence showed that WikiLeaks got these emails, potentially unknowingly, from a Russian government agent who, like Assange, was trying to damage the Clinton campaign. The leaked emails helped the Trump campaign and quickly made Assange an enemy of American progressives who had tended to support Assange and WikiLeaks because they were keeping the government and the military accountable. But now they hated him.
WikiLeaks, I love WikiLeaks.
So now it's 2017 and Trump is president.
This WikiLeaks is unbelievable.
Assange is still in the embassy. And from the embassy, Assange and WikiLeaks drop another huge leak, this time of CIA documents. It revealed the playbook of the CIA's cyber warfare strategy. Releasing all of these documents had one major result, making all of the CIA's tools completely worthless. Trump, who had praised WikiLeaks for like helping him get elected, now hated WikiLeaks.
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing.
WikiLeaks walks like a hostile intelligence service and talks like a hostile intelligence service.
So by 2019, Julian Assange is still in the embassy. And now he's pissed off everyone for one reason or another. It's at this time that the Trump administration starts to really get serious about how do we get this guy and how do we punish him severely for what he's done. They start upping the ante on their case against Julian Assange. But Assange starts to get really restless in the embassy. I mean, can you blame him? It's been like 7 years. He starts to mistrust his hosts. And in turn, his hosts, the Ecuadorian diplomats, are getting kind of tired of him. His poor hygiene, his habit of playing football in the hallways. Meanwhile, Ecuador's new president is like less sympathetic to WikiLeaks because he was actually the subject of some embarrassing leaks himself. He actually called Assange a miserable hacker whose only goal is to destabilize governments. And so, they kicked him out.
The British police were seemingly invited into this very small embassy.
7 years after he had walked into this building, Assange finally left.
They must resist.
He was immediately arrested. Again, on paper, the UK government wanted him because of this sexual investigation in Sweden from 2012. That investigation had been dropped, and yet the UK kept him in jail because the US had formally requested Assange to be extradited, which basically means one country asks another country to detain and send a criminal back to their country to face charges. The UK would hear and assess the US's request, and in the meantime, Assange would sit in the Belmarsh prison, 45 minutes from central London. And that's where he is today when I'm filming this. And he's not doing great. He's been examined by doctors and by the UN representative for torture. And they've basically concluded that Assange has experienced severe psychological trauma because of his isolation in the embassy and now in jail, including extreme stress, chronic anxiety, intense psychological trauma. The British government, of course, disagreed with this, but the UN has said that he has been subject to psychological torture and other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment of punishment. They also claim that he's been medically neglected. Many are calling this retaliation, punishing Assange, not legally, but through these really inhumane ways of not giving him medical treatment, isolating him in ways that aren't warranted. And now is the moment where we need to remind ourselves why this man is in jail. Not because he's been charged with a crime, but because he published hundreds of thousands of classified documents that an Army intel analyst, Chelsea Manning, gave to him. And the US wants to punish him. So he's rotting in a jail, waiting for the legal process on whether or not he's going to get sent back to the US to face these charges. And to me, this gets to the most important part of this story, because what happens next affects not just Julian Assange and his story, but it could set a precedent for all of us, those of us who do journalism and those of us who rely on journalism to teach us about the world. What I want to do next is I want to dive into this stuff. I want to walk you through these two documents, which are basically the US's case against Julian Assange, as laid out by the Trump administration in 2018. It's daunting, it's a lot of stuff, it's a lot of legal jargon, but I've been through it all, and I want to explain why this matters. Okay, let's do this.
Oh shit, there we go.
Okay. So stick with me as I explain the legal case against Julian Assange and what that means for journalism. The thing that the Department of Justice focuses on is the events of 2010, when Assange received tons of classified cables and war logs from intel analyst Chelsea Manning, who was previously Bradley Manning, has transitioned to Chelsea Manning. Manning had a security clearance, violated that security clearance, and ended up serving 7 years in prison for leaking all of this stuff to WikiLeaks. It would have been 35 years if Obama hadn't lessened her sentence. So the US focuses on this super giant leak. They start out by reminding us just how many documents were leaked. If you add this up, it's like over 700,000 classified documents were leaked to the world. And then they go into the actual crimes, what they see as the crimes. There's 18 counts, basically 18 instances where they allege he broke the law. In total, this would be a sentence of 175 years in prison. Luckily, we don't have to go through all 18 counts to understand them, because they fit pretty nicely into three main buckets: hacking, aiding, and publishing. First, let's go into hacking, the first bucket.
It's about assisting the hacking.
This first allegation is the least scary for Julian Assange. It basically says that Assange worked with Manning to crack a password on a government computer so that Manning could grab documents without being detected. Incidentally, it didn't work. They didn't crack the password, but the indictment alleges that he tried, and therefore it is considered a conspiracy to commit computer fraud, which is a violation of this like 80s era law called the Computer Fraud Abuse Act. It has a max sentence of 5 years, which for Julian Assange is not that big of a deal, given that he spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy evading the charges. Okay, so that's the first one, the least severe. The other 17 counts allege that Julian Assange violated the Espionage Act.
He has to answer for what he has done.
Wait, what? The Espionage Act? Hold on. You know I printed it off and read through the Espionage Act. I mean, look at that cool font. The Espionage Act is really intense. It was passed in 1917 when we were fighting World War I. I'm gonna read some of it here. Whoever, for the purpose of obtaining information respecting United to States or to the advantage of any foreign nation, or otherwise obtains information concealing work, any defense, vessel, navy yard, submarine base, fueling station, port, dockyard, battery, canal, railroad, arsenal, camp, factory, mine. Holy smokes, I could keep going. This law was meant to punish people who were government employees or members of the military who had government secrets and went and gave them to another nation that then hurt the United States. Basically spies, espionage, that's what it's about, espionage. Chelsea Manning violated this because she was a member of the military. She had a security clearance. She violated that security clearance by using her privileged information and therefore broke this law. But Julian Assange is not that. He has never worked for the US government. He's never had a security clearance. He's an Australian hacker and activist. It is very, very rare that the Espionage Act is used against somebody who is not a government employee, who does not have a security clearance. So what is going on here? How is the US trying to use the Espionage Act against an Australian who didn't leak any information? He published information that was leaked to him. So bucket two, I'm calling aiding or helping. The US case here uses the Espionage Act to say that indeed it was Chelsea Manning who broke the law directly. As an Army intel analyst, it was her who had access to the secrets. She leaked them. But in US federal law, we have this thing that says that if you aid someone in committing a crime, you are punishable kind of as if you've broken the law yourself. Yep, got it right here. Title 18, folks, Crimes and Criminal Procedure. Whoever commits an offense against the United States or aids, abets, counsels, commands, induces, or procures its commission is punishable as a principal. If you helped out, you did it too. So they use this law to say, yeah, Julian, you didn't do the hacking and leaking, but like you helped. You aided, abetted, counseled, induced, or procured and willingly caused Manning to do this because you promised that you were going to publish all this stuff. So that was sort of like incentivizing Chelsea Manning to do this. And that is why you are being punished under the Espionage Act. Wait, this is a giant deal. This is a big deal. This logical chain that was just created. Assange is being charged with aiding Manning, a convicted spy, because he published the things that the spy gave to him, okay? File that away for a second. Let's get on to the third bucket in here. The third bucket I'm calling publishing. Counts 15 through 17. And let's just read directly straight here from the indictment. The government says that Assange, having unauthorized possession of all of these reports from Afghanistan and Iraq and the State Department, etc., which again, he had sort of induced Manning to give to him, they then specifically allege that the crime here is that having all of these documents, he then communicated those documents to the world by publishing them on the internet. Whoa. The crime is publishing. That's the crime. Counts 15 through 17 are that he published something. Okay, we're done with the legal talk here. Let's talk about what this means. Back to our three buckets here. The first one is the least scary to me. Did Assange try to help Manning hack a password so that he could remain anonymous? Maybe. The facts aren't super robust here, but whatever. If there is evidence for that and he gets convicted, that's 5 years in prison. Okay. It's these other two buckets that use the Espionage Act that say that Assange was aiding Manning because he promised to publish the documents. And then he went further and committed three more crimes by actually publishing them to all the world on the internet. Let me explain something about journalism really quick. New York Times article about Iran, doesn't matter, whatever. When you read the international section or the politics section of any big newspaper, you will see quotes from officials inside the government or diplomats or whatever who request to remain anonymous, quote, because of the sensitivity of the subject. What this means is some government official talked to the reporter at the New York Times and said, hey, I kind of want to remain anonymous because I'm not really supposed to be talking to you about this, but I think the information that I'm giving you is for the public interest, and so I'm going to do it anyway. Please don't reveal my name. And the New York Times is like, okay, cool, and they publish it. That happens every single day, all of the time. That is one of the most important aspects of journalism, is that a journalist can have a source who feels protected because they can remain anonymous even if they talk about sensitive or classified information. Why? Because in our society, we value the flow of important information for the public, even if the government has deemed it to be classified. So according to the indictment from the Department of Justice, any New York Times article that is quoting a government official who's talking about classified information, if the New York Times publishes that, espionage. I mean, that's what they're saying here. In fact, tons of the leaks that WikiLeaks published in 2010 and 2011 were also published by Der Spiegel or the New York Times or the Guardian. Oh wait, but Julian Assange isn't a journalist. He's not like the New York Times reporter. Those are like technically legitimate journalists. No. Journalist is not a legally defined status. Journalists don't enjoy some upgraded version of free speech. All journalism takes place within the free speech laws that all of us enjoy. Oh, and I don't really need to say this, but those laws, those protections are really, really important. Free speech is what keeps our society transparent. It keeps our government accountable. It is important. And it is rare. It's a new thing. Like, being able to hold governments accountable is like kind of a brand new thing in human civilization. It's not natural, it's not guaranteed, it can easily go away. So that is why I'm concerned about this case. Yeah, go ahead, charge Julian Assange with the conspiracy to hack into a government computer. But as soon as you introduce the Espionage Act into what he did, you start to play with fire. You're setting a precedent that could easily be applied to the journalism that we rely on every day to keep us informed and to keep governments and businesses accountable. Oh, and I'm not the only one who's concerned by this. The Obama administration also worried that pursuing Assange would be dangerous for free speech and journalism. So they didn't do it. It was the Trump administration that really doubled down and tried to get Assange and charge him. And I mean, are we surprised? So the Biden administration is sort of at a crossroads. Like, what are they gonna do? Are they gonna push this? Are they gonna try to charge Julian Assange with espionage? Well, it turns out they are moving ahead trying to get him extradited to the US. Okay, wait. There's been news. We were making this video, we were editing it just because we're interested in Julian Assange, and then news broke that
the UK judge will rule tonight on whether WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange should be extradited to the United States.
Where a judge basically said that it's totally legal that Assange be sent to the US to face trial.
A judge approved the extradition earlier today.
Meaning he's one step closer to being extradited. Now, he will probably appeal this. It'll probably go to the High Court in the UK, but like, he's one step closer.
How long could this drag out?
Sometime. Maybe not so much time.
My whole purpose in making this video was not to defend Julian Assange as a person or even WikiLeaks as an organization. That's not the point. You can make up your mind on that. The thing that I hope I've persuaded you, though, is that Julian Assange's legal case has ramifications for all of us. If he's sent to the US and he's convicted under the Espionage Act, that will have major ramifications on the future of journalism. I hope that is clear now. So, over the coming weeks and months, this case will play out, and you know that I will be paying attention to it, and my hope is that you will be too. All right, that's it. That's all I've got for today. This was a really deep dive. We spent a lot of time on this, and I hope it was helpful in some way. So thank you all for watching, for being here. Lots more to come. Hopefully videos in the future that are not as heavy and depressing as this one, but this one's important. So glad you watched it. Thanks for being here and have a wonderful day.
Again, I want to thank Johnny Harris for his work on this. But boy, it is a sobering reminder of how indifferent and biased the major media is who's used Julian Assange's work over the years and won awards for writing about what he has exposed. Yet he still sits in jail, and neither the Republicans or Democrats in power, who could have exonerated him, who could have pardoned him, have chosen to do so. Does that tell you how absolutely corrupt and culpable and unethical and immoral they are? Thank you all for listening to this program, watching the videos. I'll share more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. Oh, and by the way, tonight on the Progressive Commentary Hour, a searing indictment about the scientific community and what we weren't told, the truth about COVID. More information you should know, especially if you were vaccinated. Listen tonight, 7 o'clock, PRN.live. Thank you and have a nice day.